Cancer Research UK podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Kat Arney, and in this month's podcast, we're bringing you all the latest news and research progress from the NCRI Cancer Conference in Birmingham, the biggest of its kind in the UK. Every October, thousands of people from the UK and around the world gather at the International Convention Centre in Birmingham for a very special event, the National Cancer Research Institute, or NCRI, Cancer Conference. Bringing together scientists, doctors, nurses, charities and patient groups, the conference is a showcase for the latest research into the disease. For the past few years, the conference has started with a public talk, and this year was no exception. Cancer Research UK's Professor Michelle Coleman gave a fascinating lecture about cancer statistics. Yes, I really did say that. Explaining the true figures that underlie the perception of the UK as the sick man of Europe when it comes to cancer survival. I asked him if he thought this portrayal was true.
No, I don't think Britain is the sick man of Europe. I think that's a nice headline for a newspaper that is almost too facile. It doesn't really tell us anything useful. What we do know is that in the UK, or its four constituent countries, which have different patterns of cancer to some degree, that the level of occurrence of these cancers has been higher than in some, and so we need to improve prevention, such as, for example, reducing the amount of smoking, which will reduce a number of major cancers such as of the lung and pancreas, for example, and that's actually happened amongst men in the UK over the last 20 or 30 years. But I was asked to focus particularly today on patterns of survival and how they had influenced cancer care in the UK. So I focused my remarks mainly on the so-called Eurocare studies, which, as the name suggests, are studies looking at the outcome of cancer across European countries. Now, the first one was published in 1995, and the most recent in 2007, a total of four such studies. And the first covered only 12 countries, including England and Scotland, and the most recent covered 23 countries, including all four of the home nations. And if you look at those studies in the round, survival from most of the major cancers has been lower in the four UK nations than the average for Europe. But it's not true for all cancers. And I thought it was important to point this out today in response to questions from the audience, that it's not some devastating failure of the entire system or of data collection which has produced these figures like some kind of artifact. No, if you look at Scotland, for example, survival from melanoma is higher than the European average and quite close to the highest in Europe. And if you look at cancer of the testis in men or Hodgkin's disease, which is a common type of lymphoma, mainly in younger people, that occurs, of course, in both sexes, the survival for those cancers is as good as or better than the European average, and in some cases quite a lot better. And that suggests to me that if we get it right in this country, and we're clearly capable of getting it right, we can achieve just as good results as anywhere else. And where we don't, where the survival from cancers in this country, and I speak more generally of England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, but let's put them together, where our survival rates have been lower than we would like and lower even than the European average for some time, in many cases we have been catching up. And that was most obvious perhaps for breast cancer, which I focused on today because October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And you can see that survival in the British nations has been not only improving, but improving slightly faster than in comparable countries with which we have often been unfavourably compared. And that suggests that we have been doing things better, relatively, as it were, better than in the past. So I don't think we're the sick man of Europe. What we have been looking at is a National Health Service that has been underfunded and less well organised than it should be.
Another interesting and somewhat controversial talk that got a great deal of media coverage came from Cancer Research UK's Professor Valerie Beryl, based at the University of Oxford. She's a leading expert on the risks and causes of breast cancer, so I asked her to explain a bit more about what these major risks are.
Really, the main things that we've known about for centuries is it's really women's childbearing patterns, which is really how many children women have the young, what their age when they have them, and whether they breastfeed them or not. And if a woman, essentially, if a woman has many children starting at early age and breastfeeds them for quite a while, her risk of breast cancer is much reduced by a factor. If women in the, by a very large extent, if women in this country had as many children as they do in developed countries, not that I'm suggesting they do, and breastfed them for as long, instead of 1 in 15 getting breast cancer by the time they were 70, it would be closer to 1 in 50 or so.
And how do we know that there's this solid link between childbirth and breast cancer?
Well, it's been known about for centuries, but a little bit forgotten, I think. It was known, for example, that nuns in Italy had about 6 to 7 times as much breast cancer as other women in Italy. It's been known for a long time that single women have higher rates of breast cancer. Women with breast cancer have fewer children, than even if they're married, than women who don't have breast cancer. It's all been known about for centuries. But we got a bit waylaid. We thought, oh, we know all of that. Let's get on to something else. But actually, the point is that that's the main reason that women get breast cancer. All the other things are much more minor. We almost forget the things that we know and try and discover something new and novel, whereas it's the old-fashioned things that are really the most important.
So what's the actual biological root of this? Why does having more children and breastfeeding protect you?
It's almost taken for granted that this is so, and so there hasn't, it's not a big topic of research why it should be or what one could do about it. And that's really what I was saying today, was why don't we know more about why, and why don't we try and use that information and for prevention? And that, to my knowledge, is not happening very much.
And is it specifically the sort of the actual giving birth and pregnancy? Yeah. Because I understand that there isn't really a link between miscarriages or abortions and breast cancer.
No, it's, we actually know, and this is from very thorough worldwide data with hundreds of thousands of women and comparison groups, that we know that a short-term, a pregnancy isn't what's protective, it's actually a birth. A pregnancy that, say, ends as a miscarriage or abortion that lasts for a few months does not protect against breast cancer. The birth has to, the pregnancy has to go on to the end. And so that's a clue that we should be using to try and understand what's going on.
So potentially could be a very potent source of protective factors, yes, if we could, say, bottle it and exactly, give it to women.
Exactly. And you know, a pregnancy lasts 9 months and it gives you lifelong protection against breast cancer. And we really should be finding out what it is. It must be some of the hormones that are produced that are doing this, that make the breast change. We should be really trying to do that, and would require treatment over a number of months at a young age, which could give you lifelong protection. That's where we should be heading.
Many researchers use the conference as an opportunity to present exciting new findings. Professor Nazneen Rahman from the Institute of Cancer Research in Surrey revealed her new discovery into the causes of Wilms' tumour, a type of kidney cancer that affects children. I asked her to explain more about her results and what they might mean for children with this disease and their families.
So the new thing that we found isn't actually a gene per se, in fact. What it is that we've shown is that defects in certain growth factors can be a cause of Wilms' tumour. In children, obviously, growth is under quite tight control, really, from conception onwards. There has to be a lot of growth, the baby has to grow, and then slowly growth has to be suppressed so that, you know, you don't grow forever. So there's quite tight control, both promoting and suppressing growth. And what we've known from some rare genetic syndromes is sometimes if that growth control goes wrong, so you've got too much growth, that can also be associated with tumours in childhood, particularly Wilms' tumour. So what we did was to look at whether that could also be the case for children who are otherwise well, who don't have a genetic syndrome, but just have Wilms' tumour. So we were looking at these growth factors, and we found that there were defects in those growth factors in around about 5% overall of children with Wilms' tumour, and about 3% don't have any other features. They don't have a genetic syndrome, they've just got Wilms' tumour. And occasionally those things can also be inherited, and so that has implications for the family generally. So I think the importance of the work was partly finding out one of the causes of Wilms' tumour, and that can be very helpful for families if they know why a child has got Wilms' tumour. And we know that if you've got these growth defects, it means that you're more at risk of having your second kidney affected. And again, that's very important for treating the child so that we can make sure that it's treated properly, but you don't take all the kidneys out so that they still have some kidney function. And for the families where it's relevant, it means that we can see whether anybody else might be at risk and potentially give them screening to pick up a Wilms tumour early if that's appropriate.
And could this be developed into actually some kind of test that could be applied?
Yes. Yeah, so one of the things that we were doing was in terms of the defects that we found, they are quite complicated. There's a lot of different ways in which these growth factors can be affected. So we helped to develop a test that does exactly that, can look in a single experiment that can take place just on one sample in a day to look to see whether these growth defects are present. And that's already been taken up by the NHS. So for children with Wilms tumour, this test is now available where appropriate and can be done already.
And what are the implications for treating these children who do have these growth defects?
Well, so as I said, generally Wilms tumour is very treatable, so that's great. But if you've got both kidneys affected, in particular, it can be difficult because you want to make sure that you can both treat the Wilms tumour but also retain enough kidney to preserve kidney function. And so in those cases, it's very useful to know whether or not somebody might be at risk of having Wilms tumour affecting both kidneys. So you can ensure that you're keeping a careful eye on the other kidney in case any other trouble from Wilms tumour occurs, but also that you can manage it appropriately. So that's really where I think it's going to be very helpful.
One of the most popular sessions at the conference was about the cost of cancer care, including a talk from Professor Mike Richards, National Cancer Director for England, who outlined several ways in which he thought that money could be saved and redirected within the NHS. I started by asking him where we stand now in terms of health service spending on cancer.
Well, we know a lot more about the cost of cancer care than we did a few years ago. We know overall that we spend about 5% of the NHS budget on cancer care. We spend in total around £4.5 billion a year on cancer care. And we now know a lot more about how that is distributed between inpatient care, treatment with drugs, treatment with surgery, treatment with radiotherapy, screening, all those different elements. And the largest single element of that is inpatient care.
So that's people coming into hospital, staying in hospital.
Absolutely right. Sometimes coming into hospital because they are unwell, but not because they need an operation, for example.
And so is there any way that we could maybe reduce these costs or be more efficient about how we use the budget the NHS has?
Absolutely, yes. We've done a lot of work looking with people from other countries about how we are using our inpatient beds and how they would in their own countries. And it's quite clear that we could be more efficient, and that would actually be good for patients and for the NHS. Patients don't want to spend longer than they need to in hospital, and from an NHS point of view, it costs a lot of money. And I believe we can streamline the processes of care for people who need to come into hospital. In some cases, we ought to be able to avoid them having to come into hospital by having good day case facilities. And if we can do that, our estimate is that across the country, we could probably save as much as £350 million a year.
And there are also new techniques, for example, things like keyhole surgery, enhanced recovery. Could they make a real impact?
Absolutely, yes. We've already seen a very significant change over the years. When I first became a consultant, a woman having a breast surgery would probably be in hospital for 10 days. Then it went down to 5 days. And now in a lot of places, it would be done either as a day case procedure or perhaps one overnight stay. So we've seen a great deal of change in that area. And I think one of the other areas is the one you mentioned, keyhole surgery, and sometimes robotic surgery as well, which can enable patients to recover more quickly. And that's, again, good for patients, getting them home and up and moving more quickly, but it's also good for the NHS.
And now to some of the issues that obviously get picked up by the media because they're quite controversial. You mentioned that the spend on cancer is it 5% of the NHS budget. How does that compare with other countries?
Well, it's broadly in line with some other countries, but we know that it's a bit below the amount that is spent in either France or Germany. But we don't have enough cross-national studies, I think, at the moment, and it would be very useful to have more information on spend in different countries, and not only what the total spend is, but how they're spending it. What proportion is being spent on patients being in hospital, what proportion is being spent on drugs and things like that. And we are working on those things at the moment.
And turning to the issue of drugs, it's always something that really attracts people's attention and a lot of controversy. Do you think that freeing up more money from the NHS budget for cancer drugs would make an impact?
Yes, I think we need to constantly be looking at how we're using the money and using it to best effect. This is taxpayers' money. We need to spend it wisely. We need to get the maximum benefit for patients from this money. Obviously, we would all want to see more money being put into prevention and to screening programmes, which are highly cost-effective. But we also need to be able to put more money into good radiotherapy facilities and good new drugs. We can do that, I believe, if we really look across the board at using the whole budget most equitably and efficiently.
If you want to find out more about some of the speakers and the talks from the conference, then have a look at our Science Update blog. That's scienceblog.cancerresearchuk.org. My colleagues and I have been writing reports from some of the most interesting sessions, and you can find links to longer interviews with some of the world's leading cancer researchers. Well, we've reached the end once more, so I do hope you've enjoyed this month's podcast. Please send us your feedback by email to podcast@cancer.org.uk. We'll be back next month with all the latest news from Cancer Research UK, and we'll be finding out how simple organisms like yeast can provide new clues to cancer. So until then, goodbye.